listener production.
I've saved myself a heap of money, not by sacrifice, by rearranging what the conversation was and where we would be spending our time and effort.
G'day, I'm Scott Phillips, the Motley Fool's Chief Investment Officer and the host of The Good Oil. Now, hopefully you've been around the track a few times. Hopefully you know what we do. But if you don't, if you've forgotten or if you're new, The Good Oil, the phrase The Good Oil, is giving someone the good stuff, the important stuff, and the real stuff, which, as you know, is the aim of this very podcast. We bring you conversations with entrepreneurs, executives, and experts, the people who know what's going on, and the people who make things happen. And as always, today's guest is someone who really knows what's going on, and he is also an entrepreneur who is making it happen. Owen Rask, welcome to The Good Oil.
Scott, absolute pleasure. I'm so thrilled that you've asked me to come on. Thank you.
Well, mate, you're very kind to join us. Now, you and I have a history, which we will go into in a little bit of time. Mate, I generally like to ask people just to give our listeners a bit of a pulse check of what's actually happening out there, the proverbial out there. We know we're recording this in early October 2023, mate. In fact, we're recording this on interest rates day. So by the time this goes to air, our listeners will know. We don't yet know what the RBA might do this afternoon. But, mate, just from your vantage point, from the people you work with, the people you speak to, what are you seeing? What's going on out there? How is life in the broader economy in terms of what they're seeing anyway?
So I spend a bit of my time, I juggle two businesses. One is the RAS Group, which people know, where I spend a lot of time talking about investing, similar to yourself.
Yep.
Not nearly as well polished, I might say, though, Scott. And on the other side, I'm a business coach, so I help a lot of small businesses. Mm-hmm. And what I'm seeing is basically a dichotomy for the most part. So companies reporting strong financial results. Okay. How long that goes on, I don't know. Mm. There's obviously pockets of weakness, but I spend a lot of my time in technology companies.
Right.
So they're pretty strong at the moment, defying a lot of gravity, you could say. And then on the other side, with the small businesses, they're really struggling. So more than I've seen in a very long time. And that's not just because of interest rates. It's also because of discretionary spending and things like instant asset write-offs and these types of things being wound back. So that's... I don't think that's yet to have the full impact, but what I'm seeing is a lot of weakness, and I think that's going to get worse before it gets better.
Nice, mate. Well, not nice, terrible, but hopefully things do improve. Thank you for the insight. And again, it's always important, I think, to check on individual companies, individual people, and the things that you're specifically seeing out there really, really matters. Mate, let's get into, we'll get into our background in a little bit, but you mentioned some of the businesses that you run. You're a very, very busy man. even the RAS Group itself is not one business, but I think it's about 85 last time I checked. So mate, here's, jump up on the pedestal on the platform. Just tell our listeners, what is the RAS Group firstly, and then we'll get on to the business coaching. But what's the RAS Group? Tell us about that.
Yeah, sure. So I spent a bit of time trying to polish this script, so hopefully it comes out a bit more succinct. But as you know, we worked together at The Motley Fool. It was a wonderful place to work. In 2017, I decided to focus my attention on financial education in Australia. And since 2017, we've now grown to become one of the larger providers of whether it's online courses. We've got about 24,000 students. We've got podcasts about 200,000, give or take up to 200,000 listeners of those podcasts every month. Mm. And that goes from everything from investing, small business, to property, which is something that took me to some convincing to get across to. but we finally made the commute. And and then we obviously do a lot of the other things like people would know us for, investing, those research style things. So I do, I know we often talk about this, you and I, but I think it's a credit to you and to the Motley Fool. Being such a wonderful organization that it is, I was able to do that and basically say, okay, guys, my time is up for now at the Motley Fool. Mm. And everyone in the team has been so wonderfully supportive, even for you to invite me on today. So, and that I hope goes both ways. But yeah, this is what I do. And basically, I see my role these days is now there's a team around me. I see my role as just trying to think about what's the big picture problem that we have in Australia. And a lot of it is accessing advice. For the financial education and financial wellness side of things. And so whether that's advice on a business, whether it's financial planning, retirement, whether it's investment advice, for more and more Australians becoming out of touch. And that's a real problem because it has a lot of generational issues, I think, as well. Mm. Poor hygiene with money is not necessarily something that stops at one generation. So that's our mission. Our mission is to basically democratize that.
I love it, mate. That's really, really important. As you say, we've been mates for a long time. We've worked together for a few years up until you decided to go and start Rask, which we're pretty excited about. I mean, look, to some degree, our businesses kind of overlap a little bit. But I've said for a long time, mate, between you guys, us, there's a couple of others out there, this industry is massive and frankly full of less than ideal businesses and people in large part. And I don't say that to cast too many aspersions on everyone. There are absolutely the good guys out there, but it's one of those things, mate. If the Motley Fool and Rask are doing half decent jobs each, there is more than enough room for us each to grow and be really successful over a long period of time without needing to worry about each other. You know, if we're fighting that particular corner, then we're missing the point. That being said, as you said, not a lot of overlap, a little bit, which is obvious. But in this case, mate, more power to you. And you know, there's the old word frenemies. I don't know if we're necessarily that, but I will happily cheer on your success and a couple others, as I said, in the space. But it's an important thing to be doing. Mate, I want to go back to that story. A lot of our listeners love the entrepreneurial journey. And I'll ask you the question I ask many, many people. Now, you're a young bloke, which as you know well means I hate you. Because the one thing I can't get back is years. So you've got it over me on that one. But mate, I've been doing this now for a decade or 12 years. There are some people, you've left to start your own business. Andrew Page from Strawman's another one who's done that, another previous guest on the podcast. I don't know that I have it in me to throw in the day job. Now, I love my job, by the way, which also helps, but to throw in the day job and go, you know what, I'm going to start my thing. I'm going to do my thing. You've done that. And so I guess what my first question on this part of this journey is, how do you get to the point where it's like, I've got a good job, paying okay, working hopefully with people you are enjoying working with, or maybe you hate us, in which case feel free to say that now. But on the off chance that was true. And then you go, you know what, I'm chucking the whole thing in. I'm doing this myself. Again, entrepreneurs listening are like, oh, that's easy, I get that. Other people listening are going, I would never do that. Tell us your version, your story of coming to, or maybe thinking through and then wrestling with and coming to the decision of, I'm out of here, I'm doing this myself, it's now my thing, I'm taking the leap.
Yeah, one thing that you often say is history doesn't repeat, but it does rhyme. And I think what we see with entrepreneurialism is that it does tend to rhyme throughout someone's life. So it tends to thread through our lives without us really noticing. And I think for me, it goes back to when I was a kid growing up on the farm. I learned the value of hard work and input equals output, basically. And then once I discovered that you could do more without basically moving your arms and your legs, you can do more good in the world if you use your mind more effectively. So I've always had that kind of idea that what's the maximum possible impact that I can have on the world? And for me, that was moving further and further down financial education, financial literacy. And it's interesting now because as of 2023, we did some research the other day and I thought, you know, this would just be younger people who are in need of this stuff. And we did a survey of one of our audiences the other day. So we've got four or five pretty big ones, but one of them in particular. And what we found is there are more people in their 70s that follow us than in their 20s.
Oh, wow.
And yeah, and I thought that was really bizarre. I mean, we have an association. We do all the media for the Australian Shareholders Association, which I know you know. Mm-hmm. And so maybe there's a big skew there, but I thought that was really peculiar. And those people are looking for answers to questions like, how do I give my money to the next generation effectively? How can I structure my affairs? But then younger people are typically looking to accumulate assets. And prior to the Motley Fool, but I mean, the best type of marketing that you could get, the best type of education you could get was marketing. So you could go to the Commonwealth Bank of Australia's website, you click on the education tab, and it's education about product, right?
Yeah.
Which is it was so bizarre to me that it seemed like no one wanted to educate. Obviously, that's changed in a big way thanks to people like yourself, thanks to Bruce and the Motley Fool at large. And that's really changing now. And that's wonderful. But for me, I sat back and I saw this huge issue that we had. And I'm not one of those people that sit down and do a life plan like Miyoshi-san or anyone like this. Like it was just I just realized that if there was asymmetry in my life, I thought that if I was going to take risk, doing it as a younger person was the single best time for me to do it, because I didn't want to, when I have kids, I didn't want to be the person that takes that risk with both feet or at least one foot in the water. I wanted to make sure that for the most part, I took that risk when there was more asymmetry, there was more upside and less downside. Mm. And the way you do that is you focus on the things that you can control. And for me, I knew that one thing that I would have is time to recover from severe financial loss. And that might still be the case, but I'd rather do that when I was in my late 20s, early 30s than do it in my 50s or 60s. And I speak to a lot of business owners in that camp. And there's nothing wrong with that, but it was just something that for me, if I was going to do it, if my partner was going to let me do it, frankly, I would do it when I was young. So yeah. You're right. Like they say, the first job out of school is by far the most profound. And for me, that was the Motley Fool. And I realized the value of entrepreneurialism and growth focus. Like it was never a thing where it was like, of course there's risk and these types of things, but it was like, how can we help more? How can we serve more people? And that's a very different attitude to the other focus, which is how can we protect what we've already got first? Mm. And I think if you're in that type of environment, it's just infectious. So the risk for me was never really substantial, I could say. If the opportunity is there, I just grabbed it, and that's what I did.
Mate, and you've done remarkably well. When I look at what you've done since you left the Fool, mate, the phrase that comes to mind is take as big a bigger bite as you can and chew like mad. Because you didn't sort of say, let me do one thing and let me really prove that out, and then let me try a second thing. I don't know how many RASC websites there are, but I want to say there's at least five that I can just roll off into my head. You do, as you say, four different podcasts. You've literally made, you've created yourself a multimedia empire, if I can call it that, online, obviously, but between you know, the websites, the podcasts, the email, and then actually some of the education stuff you're doing as well. You really took out a massive bite, mate. I'm curious as to how you thought through that part of your process or the growth plan. As I said, I looked at what you were doing and said, man, you know, and I'm really, really excited to see how well you've done, mate, because, you know, you walked into some really difficult areas. Monetizing education, and I know it's not just about monetizing, it's about the education piece for you, but doing that successfully is a really, really, really tough slog. Now, on one hand, no one was doing it, so there was an opportunity. On the other hand, no one was doing it because it's very, very hard to do well and to monetize well and to be able to just stay in business. And when I say monetize, I don't even necessarily mean, you know, driving Ferraris. I mean literally just being able to pay back the investment you're putting into it. Podcasts similarly, I think, you know, 2017, I don't know if you imagined that you'd have four large podcasts that are, you know, around the, you're all in the top 10 business and finance podcasts. You've absolutely kind of made every post a winner. But how did you think through the growth strategy once you'd taken the leap? How did that all come about for you?
Yeah, I've got to admit, like, I appreciate that, Scott, but I've got to admit, like, it's not perfect. And I think a lot of business owners think that there's going to be, you know, the hedonic treadmill. I'll be happy when. It's going to work when. Mm. And the reality is that just never happens. So, like, a lot of the studies show that in order to get confidence, you need to basically make it happen for yourself. Mm. And so by doing, you actually get confidence. And that was definitely the thread that I pulled on to kind of conjure up my inner Bezos. He speaks about, like, these really complex problems, and it's like a kind of like a, I don't know, ball of wool, and you just got to pull one to see if it unravels. And if that doesn't work, you just pull the next one. And for me, that's great. It's a great idea. That was spaghetti at the wall trick, but sooner or later you come up with scaling issues. And so what I wanted to do, and what I realized, is that a lot of the businesses that do exceptionally well in our society today are businesses that aggregate demand. Mm. So if you look at an extreme example, just look at Google basically monopolized the internet through search. And once it has that, then it's much easier for it to move into a different vertical. Like, oh, okay, we've got Google Drive, and now we've got Maps, and now we've got YouTube. And you can just see them basically turn the fire hose to a different mm-hmm. product. The problem is a lot of people don't know how to do that. And basically the only ways to play these days, you stay in like a regional area, you're focused, like say you have a building, you're a builder and you on the Central Coast, well, you'd advertise on the Central Coast and you'd stay in that area. So you're geographically bound, and you can use online mediums to do that. But when it comes to finance, it's obviously national, so the scope is bigger. And most people, when it comes to finance, just want to get good, reliable information, which I hope we've given to them, not just through our websites, but also through our social media and those other means. But the thing that I really was, the thing that took me back with podcasts, Scott, is, and you would know this, it actually plays into human nature far more powerfully than any other medium that I've come across. So you could be listening to this right now while I was listening to The Good Oil with you and Lindsay while I was driving, Lindsay from Brickworks, of course. And you could be listening to this and hearing my voice and you're driving on your way to pick up the kids, or you could be listening to this while you're in the gym. And it sounds like I'm talking directly to you, like Scott and I are having this conversation and you're in the room. And why that's really important, I realized in the early days, is because when it comes to finance, people don't want to talk about it. So it sounds like this discussion is happening in your head and you're okay in this area. You're fine. And what I realized is that's why the podcasts have grown so fast, is because for finance in particular, it's something that most people don't want to talk about. Mel Brown talks about this. She mentioned it years ago on Triple J. She said, more people would rather stand naked in front of other people and talk about their finance, right?
So very true, mate, yeah.
So that's how I made the choice, Scott. It was basically for the business perspective. It was, I looked across it. We had podcasts, we had websites. We owned our own audience effectively. Like, we've never spent, in the entirety of RAS, we've never spent more than $10,000 of ads. It's all been content marketing. And what I realized is I was thinking, geez, these podcasts are growing. They were compounding. I don't know what the word for this is. When we say CAGR, we normally mean compound annual growth rate. I don't know what the equivalent is for monthly, compound monthly growth rate. I don't know how I'd pronounce that. But we were growing. Over 3 years, we were compounding our audience at 11% a month.
That's crazy.
So when you look back and you see those, that data in your business, and you say, which of my business lines is growing, it takes a huge dose of humility to be like, I thought it was this thing over here, but that's not nearly as effective as me selling, you know, croissants over here. I didn't think I'd be a croissant baker, but I'm going to do it because that's what's working. And that's how I made those decisions. So there's a bit of a graveyard of websites that we have, but I hope that answers the question in a roundabout way, mate.
It does, mate. It's a very good one. And I think, you know, our listeners can hear from your description the thought you've put into this, and the you obviously have read very widely and looked very widely for inspiration. For inspiration sounds like too woolly a term, but you're clearly learning at the knee, at the feet of some of the greats of business, and really refining your approach. And I think one of the things I really appreciate about you is the effort you've put into trying to suck the best out of everything you can get your hands on. You're a learning machine. You've really worked bloody hard to say, what is it that is working over here for them? What can I take from that and put on my business? What can I learn from? So on that, in that vein then, mate, again, for those business owners or potential owners, entrepreneurs listening to us, what are some of the things that have allowed you to filter most effectively? There is endless supplies of self-help books and business biographies and hagiographies, and trying to sort the wheat from the chaff is not easy. Plenty of people want their version of their story told, and frankly, mate, I've gone off a little bit some of this stuff because it's the one person at one point in time with one set of circumstances getting lucky, and I had to work bloody hard. You can't be successful without being without working really, really hard. But also without luck, there's a whole lot of people who work really hard and never get anywhere. How have you gone about filtering the inputs, the thoughts you've had, the way you've approached your business? How have you learned or deciphered how to grow from the best sources out there?
Yeah, that's such a good point, Scott. I really, the way you said that is actually really well said. I do try and act a bit like a sponge. If anything is around me that I can soak up, I will, provided it's good stuff to soak up. So. I say to my team, I say, whenever you go to a meeting, like if you want to go to a meeting and have lunch every day of the week, put it on the RAS group, go and do that. But every meeting that you have, learn something, because otherwise there's no point, right? Like don't just go and speak to someone. Like you see that in a lot of corporate style businesses. Go and actually just learn something. And you don't have to tell me what it is, but for your own benefit, go and learn that. And so whenever we are on a podcast, so like this, chatting with you, or when we spoke last week, and we caught up last week as well.
We did.
I would try and learn one thing from that interaction. I have to learn one thing. And it's not necessarily something that is a cause of anxiety for me, but I'll get to that in a sec. But it is something that I really do appreciate, like the snowball. And a lot of people think to learn, you have to read a business book, right? And then you realize that most human brains can you know, process information at 5 times the speed of the average, you know, ability to read. So that's why speed reading works for some people. It doesn't work for me. And so you have to find what's right for you. And I found podcasts as a great way to learn. I used to take notes and do all that sort of stuff. But I think what a lot of people make the mistake of is they don't really have a North Star. I was telling the team today, I can't remember where the quote comes from, but it's basically, if you don't know where you're going, any road will take you there. And it's true, right? Like,
yeah, it is.
It's like no one has that North Star. And so what I try and do is I try and just make sure that I understand myself as much as I can. And a lot of the growth that we've experienced at the RAS Group is basically what psychologists would call sublimation. So you know a bit about my backstory, but mm-hmm. I kind of grew up in a bit of a fractured house and like pretty messy, split up with my parents. And there was a lot of time there where things were incredibly uncertain for me. And I remember saying to the team at our first retreat a few years ago, I said, what's really ironic here is that the RAS Group is a finance company and it's basically built out of my anxiety for money, because I didn't have that much growing up.
Yeah.
And so now what I know about myself is when we look at things in the newspaper, what we tend to see is we tend to see the top 20 most successful people, and that's how they'll describe it. And basically that's just a rank of people's money. That says nothing about their happiness. It says nothing about how they spend their days, whether they're lonely, whether they're sad, whether they're happy. And we put money there because money is the only currency that is universally accepted. And I think the more I realize chatting to people that are quote unquote super successful, the more I realize that a lot of those people are quite sad. So, and they're not happy as you'd expect. And so when it comes to filtering information, this is the key thing that I believe, is that remember your North Star. Remember why you are in business, why you are investing, why you are saving money, what you're doing, what is it really? And then everything else should be noise, with the exception of that you know their incentive. So a lot of people don't know the incentive of journalists or the incentive of people on social media. So when it comes to my information, I'm sure you'll ask me about that in a little bit, but when it comes to my information, I identify with the trusted sources like yourself. I follow you on Twitter, for example.
Sorry about that.
That's great. And you do bridge really well between politics and finance, which is brilliant because it helps me decipher and identify with the trusted source and be more discerning with how I consume. And so what I would say to everyone is just find the things that work for you, know the incentives, but know how it aligns with your longer term vision, because you can easily get sucked up in all the other stuff that takes you straight off course. It's easier said than done. I do have a few activities, but that's what I do.
Nice, mate. I can ask you a bit more about that. I am fascinated by people who can really framework mentally where they want to be and how they need to get there. Because there's one thing about absorbing information, and it was a great example. Thank you. And I'm mindful that you are obviously trying to do both things. You are, as you say, you want to be financially secure, but at the same time, you have a real purpose that's not just make the most money, but it's actually live the best life and help people. And that's I always find that particularly inspirational. But there's something I find in a whole lot of people. One of our former colleagues, Joe Mager, who's now living in the US, has it as well. And it's a really, really clear ability to kind of keep this, maybe it's on paper for you or maybe it's mental, I don't know for Joe either, keep this framework really, really clear and build this framework. I imagine when people like you and Joe close your eyes, you can see the framework, you can see where you're trying to go, you can see how you're trying to get there, you can see what it looks like. And if I think about, again, the breadth of RASC and everything that's going on there, I am absolutely sure that, having asked you before, that there is a master plan of sorts. As you say, it may not be a 100-year plan or a 50-year plan, but there's a plan of sorts of to how you get there. And I'm not going to ask you to divulge that because it's competitive information. But how do you go about building that framework and then keeping it front of mind so you can adjust it over time? I would need to whiteboard it. How does it work for you?
I think every business, if you haven't already done this, and people can have this as well, right, is have like a mission statement. Mm. It sounds like airy-fairy, but pick up a book like Traction or The E-Myth or whatever. Mm. And it talks about like a guiding light. And if you're in the business and you have a team already and you haven't done this, just take the team to a neutral place, like if it's a nice restaurant or a function area or even just the park, and sit down with them. Say to them, who are our customers, and get everyone to contribute and say, how do we serve them? And then you can have that North Star. But how do I do this personally? I think I have my own personal mission statement. I think about this quite a bit. And my purpose in life is basically to have the most positive impact. The thing that I'm most passionate about outside of finance and this type of thing in business is actually space. And I don't think I'm going to go to space anytime soon. So, so I think the thing for me that I feel like I can measure my impact is in finance, and I can see that play out. And at the end of the day, for a business, I just want to keep it very simple here, but at the end of the day, a business only needs to worry about two things. And I think Lindsay talked about this, is you have a cost to acquire a customer, and you have the average revenue that you get from that customer. So you, there are multiple levers that you can pull, but basically if you can attract a customer cheaper than someone else, that's your competitive advantage. If you can extract more value from a customer, that's your competitive advantage, as long as you can maintain those two things. And if you can do both wonderfully, then you're going to have a fantastic business and everything will be fine. But I take that approach also to the way I spend my time. So if you just look at like your calendar for the last week, just go back and have a look at your calendar for the last week and see where you allocated time. We do this exercise where we get people to write down, and just they divide a piece of paper into three columns, and one column they have, where did I spend the most money in order? It's normally mortgage, that sort of stuff, transportation. The next column, where did I spend the most time? So we've got finances and time, sorry. And then in the third column, what brought me the most joy? And what you'll find is that there's often, most of it's okay, but there's a little mismatch there. Like there's a little bit of a thing where you see, like, I'm spending so much time and energy on this thing, but not on this thing. And Kate, my co-host on one of our podcasts, says, when was the last time you did a to-do list that said, make my insert, you know, friend, family, whatever, insert whoever, when make them happy? Like, we normally put at the top of our list, get bread, get milk, do the budget, you know. But when was the last time you when was the last time you actually said, make my wife laugh, you know? And I think those are the types of things where if you do have, that's a framework that you can take through life. And I'll give you one final thing that I do, is that basically we get our team to sit down and design their perfect Tuesday and their perfect Saturday. So it's just a paragraph, or you could do it with emojis if you're more modern than I am. And basically what you do is you basically just lay out, what do you want your ideal day to be? And so when it comes to frameworks for life, that gives you that North Star. If you set out, like, I'm going to wake up on a Saturday, I'm going to go for a walk, I'm going to make my wife coffee, I'm going to, you know, fix, tend to the animals that I've got, and then I'm going to spend the day around the house gardening and hopefully go to family dinner or something like that. If you think about that, you don't need to do much right to get to that in Australia anyway. And so in terms of frameworks, I think I leave that as a guiding principle. But, you speak about Joe. Joe's a wonderful investor, and he's a wonderful analyst, and he's a great person to boot. So he's impressed a lot of lessons upon me, but definitely that understanding, if I could give Joe something, it would be the understanding of moving to where the markets are. So what I mean by that is, it was his idea originally. He said, hey, you should go listen to this Invest Like the Best podcast in the United States. I was like, oh, that's pretty cool. He's like, you should probably consider doing something like that in Australia. And I was like, yeah, I should. And that gave rise to our first podcast. Nice. So yeah, move to where the market is going, I guess.
Mate, I want to ask you a question that's not actually, I had not intended to ask you, it's not even necessarily about business, but I've spoken to a couple of people who are FIRE, financially independent, retire early adherents on this podcast. And
Dave and Matt.
I'm hearing a lot more from a lot more people. And I wanted to, as I said, you're a young bloke, which means I hate you, but other than that, I love you. And I want to ask you about, the role of money, because you're right, you're in the financial education space. You obviously write a lot about investing in companies. You teach investing. I do that for a quid, obviously, as well. The nexus of that, though, I was certainly brought up, not by my parents, but by society, with a more is better. You have to have all the money, you know, do all the things. That idea, as you say, of you, how do you score your life? Well, at least you can count money, so I guess it works. There's a great quote from Joseph Heller, the guy who wrote Catch 22, that Jack Bogle. I've used it before. I've shared it before, but it's the idea that one of Heller's mates says to him, "Hey, that hedge fund manager over there, he'll make more money in a day than you've ever made from the rights of Catch 22." And Heller says, "Yeah, but I've got one thing he'll never have." And the friend says, "What's that?" And he says, "Enough." And it's one thing I've kind of, you know, the other quote is, not everything that can be counted counts, and not everything that counts can be counted. I'm curious as to how you have, given you've talked a lot philosophically in the last 5 or 10 minutes about, we're talking about business, but we're really talking about life and about planning and about understanding motivations and customers and colleagues. How do you think through how much is enough? How do you talk to your students? How do you talk to your listeners? How do you talk to your team about the role of money in our lives, given that you and I, you know, our day jobs are all about, you know, making more of it. How do you, for yourself and for your team and for the people you work with and teach, get that balance right or talk to them about that?
Yeah, there's some wonderful writers that have gone through the Motley Fool over the years, Jim Sawicki, Morgan Housel. And Morgan has this saying in his book, The Psychology of Money, which is brilliant, which is, you know, wealth is everything you can't see, basically. and so, like, being rich is this idea of that you drive a BMW or Mercedes or, you know, you live in a very lovely part here in Sydney where I'm today. And that's how most people's minds, that's their version of rich. But the reality is being wealthy is just knowing what you want and being able to do that. Like, another definition of financial independence is basically being able to do what you want, when you want, with who you want. And if you think about that, you're probably closer to that than you realize. And what it does, some people say budgeting is sacrifice. I don't believe that. I believe that budgeting is about rearranging priorities.
Okay.
Because what it actually means, if you know the way you want to live your life, and money's going to have to play a role in that. If you say to me, "Hey, Owen, do you want to go out and have 10 beers at the pub on the weekend?" I'll be like, "Well, Scott, actually, that's not what I want to do. I want to spend my Saturday getting up in the morning and going for a walk. Did you want to go for a coffee instead?" I've saved myself a heap of money, not by sacrifice, by rearranging what the conversation was and where we would be spending our time and effort. And so a lot of people sit down and they go, "Oh, I don't have enough to do all of these things." A lot of the people that I speak to that are in that situation just don't know what truly makes them happy. And so once you discover what that is, like, start with why, it's like this golden moment that you have, this light bulb just go bing and the room lights up and you think to yourself, "Wow, I actually realize what I'm doing." And Ramit Sethi, who I think he wrote the book, I Will Teach You to Be Rich or something like this, and he talks about, there's a Netflix thing on this now, he talks about living your rich life, and basically your rich life is exactly what I've said, and many others have said before me, which is that once you know what you want, it's just a state of mind. Being rich is just a state of mind, and it's actually a lot easier than you think. And I know this has been up in the clouds a bit, this conversation, but if you take those steps that I said before about identifying what matters to you, how you want to spend your day, you can just prune around the outside and find that you'll be better off. And I'll give you a tangible example is I wanted to go and do Everest Base Camp. My partner, she'd rather be anywhere else in the world than doing Everest Base Camp, right? So we're fortunate that we're going to go to Europe next year. We're one of those post-COVID kind of has to happen kind of thing. And we just didn't have in the budget that it was only about 12 grand for me to go and hike Everest for 2 weeks. But we couldn't afford to do it, frankly. And so what we've done and what I did through working with my coach is we basically took the experience of what that would mean, the fresh air, the challenge, the being with people out in the open, and we've taken that exact experience and put it into a marathon in Italy. So you basically get 90% of the feeling and the emotion of what you want, but it's only going to cost me about €30. And we're going to be in Italy anyway, so that's where she wants to be for a holiday. So you can see example there where I've given up. Yes, I have. There's probably a mild amount of sacrifice there. I won't get the selfie up in Everest Base Camp or whatever, you know.
Yeah.
But at the same time, I've got 90% of the way there with 1/100th of the cost.
That is brilliant, mate. Lovely way to put it. Hey, we're getting towards the end of our time together. I want to ask you, though, a little bit about managing a team. So Rask Group, Owen Rask, mm-hmm. obviously. So this is your business, your baby. You start the business, and I assume it was just you. Maybe it wasn't, but you can tell us that story. You're now managing a lot of people. You're managing a lot of businesses. I'm curious as to how that evolution has been for you of going from I'm doing it all myself to I actually have to trust other people to do it, and I have to get the recruitment right, and I've got to make sure they're performing. And those are all very absolute, and I'm sure you'll tell me they're great people, so they don't need that much help and all that kind of stuff. But you know, there is a psychological process. There's a risk element of if I have to grow, I have to learn to give up. But the learn thing is actually what I'm most curious about, mate, is because I don't think you probably managed people before running Rask, or at least if you did, not for very long. You're still a young bloke, as I've said. How did you kind of go through that part of that part of building Rask? How did you learn to hire, recruit, delegate, train, coach, mentor, develop, hold responsible a whole lot of other people who you need to do well for Rask to be successful?
Yeah, sure. Thanks, Scott. I think the it's a work in progress. I think that's the truth. And we've been through some pretty harrowing experiences where we've gone from myself to 10 or 12, then back down to myself. And it's been, I tell you what, the most horrible thing has been letting go of people, particularly when you're a purpose-driven company. Like, it doesn't seem like these are people are my friends. They're basically my family. And so when you let go of them and you kind of send them into the abyss and they have to take care of themselves, it's very tough. And that's probably why I don't have that much hair these days, mate. But I think for the most part, the way I've thought about it is there are two different types of people. There's basically the leader and then there's the manager. I would say I'm a better leader than I am manager, because one of the things, if you look around at your company or previous places that you've worked, I remember Greg Martz from The Motley Fool, shout out to Greg. One thing that a good manager has almost always is time for you. And so I realized early on when I was building Rask is that I named it Rask, and Scott Pape's feedback to me was like, you probably don't want to name it after yourself. So I did anyway. So basically what happened was, you know, people, the reason why I wanted an individual to stand behind what we do is because if something isn't right, you can come up to me and say that that is bull dust. Right. I don't know if we can swear, but like that is bull.
I think you know what you mean. Yeah.
Because in finance, it seems like no one's accountable.
Yeah.
You go back to the Royal Commission, sure, there's some fines that are paid and whatever, but no one's accountable. Like, who's accountable to the retiree who lost all of her savings because of a rogue financial planner? Not to bash on financial planners at all, but you get the idea. And so I wanted an individual behind that. The challenge comes now, as you're alluding to, that when you go and you extend beyond yourself. And so that's why I think there's a really important role to be had that sits between the leader and the team. And that's like in an early stage business, that would be like a head of operations. They're an exceptionally important person. And we had one, and then she moved on to a different business. So that's the next hire that I'm looking for. And surprisingly in our industry, Scott, a lot of people, I would say you and I are the exception. A lot of people in finance don't like to get behind a camera, don't like to get behind a microphone. And so these people, they are out there. And they do thrive in the startup environment. The key is just finding those people. So if you are an operations manager and you're looking for a job in an early stage scale up, come let us know. But that's what I would say, because the longer you go, the more you realize you can't do everything. And if you have to consider your position, are you the leader or are you the manager? And I would say, not to butter my own bread, I would say I'm more suited to being the leader and the strategy style of things rather than the day-to-day, which I think someone else could do 10x better than me.
I think that's very true, mate. I think if anyone's been listening to this podcast, they will absolutely agree that you should be spending a whole lot of time doing exactly that, because you're obviously very good at it and very passionate about it. That's most of the work right there. Mate, take us forward again without wanting you to give away stuff that's commercially sensitive. You've built, in the 6 odd years since starting Rask, you've built a spectacularly successful business. You have a lot of, people on your databases. You have a lot of students. You have a lot of listeners. You've done remarkably well. If I ask you, what does Rask look like in 5 or 10 years' time? What are you hoping to achieve? What are you hoping the business looks like? What's the future? What's the 5 or 10 year future for Rask?
Yeah, sure. I appreciate you asking. So what I've realized is that we impact about 200,000 people, give or take. What I really want to do is I want to reach the other 49 out of 50 people who don't give a rat's about their money. Yep. And so the way to do that is basically to manage their money for them. And this is not me becoming a quote unquote active fund manager, so to speak. Right, okay. It's more about taking what financial planners do so well, and that is like protecting people's wealth, and then just giving them a way to do that. It's very hard to do in Australia with the regulation, but that's my next challenge, and that's what we're working on at the moment. And it becomes a whole different layer of scrutiny, regulation, insurance, team members, these types of things. So I've been building that for about 10 months now.
Right.
And we should be in a position to release that soon. But that's the big thing. I think the other thing that I kind of would like is, it sounds stupid, but I want more money. because I want more money because I want to be able to deploy that money in a way that allows me to cast the net even wider. So I'll give you a really tangible example. I bought the Australian Property Podcast, which is one of our new podcasts, not to be over promotional, but you'll figure that out if you go to our website. But I ended up buying that for $100,000. And interestingly, it was just the name, because the traffic that was there wasn't material to be valued in itself. So I basically just wanted the IP. So I spent $100,000 on that. And I would love to do more of those deals rather than growing everything organically. Take something which seems to be working but could blossom a little bit better in our stable. And the reason why I wish I had more money is because this is happening right now. To the comment at the top of the show was, small businesses are struggling.
Yep.
I would love to see us in 5 years where we have our businesses which we operate, and the media investing businesses, but more broadly to be able to have a small portfolio for the company where I can deploy that capital in other brands or small businesses and support them. And knowing that they would be able to come to us and have someone who is going to give them advice, someone who's not going to tell them how to run their business, and just basically unleash their creativity and their passion. I think if you just look at Soul Patts here in Australia, which I know you know,
I do.
wonderful business operators, because they just let people do what they were born to do and get out of the way. And that's such a wonderful thing for everyone. So that's what I'd love to do on a very, very, very small scale in 5 years from now.
Sounds exciting, mate. Before we get into our favorite questions, I do want to go back to something you mentioned at the very top, which is the business coaching. We haven't really talked about that in particular. We spent a lot of time talking about the media and investing businesses. And so I'm curious as to the business coaching. Maybe just in a nutshell, tell us the story of how you got into that, what you're finding doing that, and how that kind of fits in with the rest of what you're doing.
Yeah, sure. So I'll be brief, but basically I started a business coaching business, and I was always very skeptical of coaches, because I always got these emails and messages on LinkedIn saying, do you want to be a 5-belt sigma something or other? And I was thinking, this just seemed like a scam. But it wasn't until I started seeing my own psych and my own life coach, who then put it into perspective, the importance of introspection and the importance of being accountable to someone that's independent. And so as I was working through all these things with my life coach, I thought, well, this must be what really good business coaches are all about, but for businesses. And I thought, this is great. And so I explored that. And we have a business podcast, and I'm super passionate about it. And I mentioned just a moment ago that I'd love to be able to invest in small businesses. Well, investing on the ASX or on the NASDAQ or something like that is very different to investing $25,000 or $100,000 in private companies with no shareholder agreement. If they can dig it up from somewhere, then maybe they have one, or, you know, no proper constitution or no proper bank account, or, you know, all of these different things. It's just a total mess. And so what I realized is if I'm going to do that in any meaningful way, I need to get more perspective than just my own business and just what I see from the few thousand companies on the stock exchange. And so I dove into dealing with small businesses. And the way I do that is like just like a fixed fee because it's the most transparent. But a lot of those businesses, if I could give you some insights to them, I'd say most micro and small size businesses below 10 employees don't have their zero login. That would be my first thing. And why is that important? Full disclosure, I own zero shares. The reason why that is important is because if you don't have your zero login, you don't know what your business is doing financially.
Right.
So a lot of them don't know that. That would be the first thing, which is bizarre to me and a little concerning. The second thing is that everyone is just operating on rules of thumb. It's like, I think this is working. I'm not 100% sure. I think that's our audience. I haven't really thought about it. And it's because they're so busy. So just the chance to sit down and talk them through that is really cool. And I mean, I haven't said this to the community yet, but basically a big part of it is also me trying to identify great businesses that I can support financially. So it's that's where the bow comes in and it loops through.
Very, very cool, mate. I think it's a really important bit of work you're doing. And I think one of those phrases, you know what? We're taught to kind of avoid cliches, right? Except cliches are cliches because they're true. That's how they become cliches. And one of those things is time spent working on the business, not just in the business. And as you were talking about people being so busy, it does strike me that's exactly the challenge that most people have is trying to find the time to actually work on their business to improve it rather than just the hamster wheel of just do the next thing, the next thing, the next thing. And that perspective is super useful, and I'm sure you are delivering a whole lot of value for those people. Mate, let's go to our favorite questions. You've mentioned a whole lot of gurus, a whole lot of books, a whole lot of ideas, so I'm sure this will be a difficult question for you to answer only because you do so much of it. What are you reading, watching, streaming, listening to at the moment?
Yeah, I mean, only you can see this on the video here, Scott, but I've actually got the book Traction by Gino Wickman. If you haven't read the book Traction and you're a small business, and by that I mean up to 50 employees, please go and read it. It's the single best book I've come across in all my years. Just because it gives you a formula, like a broad formula for how to get a mission statement, for how to put people in the right seats. In terms of like what I read, I spend too long on Twitter or X, but in short, like I read a lot of the Farnham Street blog. I don't know if you're familiar with that, but from Shane Parrish.
Yep.
Yeah.
Big fan.
It's a wonderful, wonderful person in terms of what he's created. And I listen to his podcast. The number one podcast I listen to, never listen to ours unless I'm really passionate about the guest. The number one podcast I listen to is the Rule Breaker Investing podcast by David Gardner in the United States. So for anyone that hasn't already checked out that Motley Fool US podcast, go and check that out. And that would be where I spend a lot of my time. I know you're going to ask me about optimism, and I would say I default to any source of information that is optimistic. And why is this the case? Is because the world is getting better. 200 years ago, no one had a fridge. Now even some of the poorest people in the world have a fridge. And the world is getting better. Please go and remember that. Look around you, see everything. Things can be bad and getting better. I think that's the key insight that I got from Hans Rosling in the Factfulness book, but that would be it.
I like that, mate, and I'm going to quickly just touch on that because it's a really important point. I think there are, this, as you say, you know, I'm going to ask you optimism. This gets to, I think, I'm really sad that people can only see the bad stuff sometimes. And it's not the same as, optimism is not ignoring the bad stuff. Optimism is not saying everything therefore is perfect or no one's doing it tough or there's nothing to improve or any of those things. Optimism is saying, I think we can make things better. I think things will improve over time. That's the whole idea behind it. It makes me sad that people say, how can you say the world's getting better because these people are still living in poverty? Like, yeah, you know what they are, and that's something we should fix. There's no but. Yes, you're right. Also, I'm optimistic. And, you know, those, I find it a shame that people can't, And look, I'm arrogantly saying my worldview is right and theirs is wrong, right? So let's be honest about that. I might be wrong. But it just strikes me, as you say, if you look at the arc of history, if you look at the improvements that have been made, investing in general is about, you know, believing there are going to be better solutions for new and existing problems. That idea is so incredibly important. I think you're right. If you don't start with look how much better things are, look how they'll continue to improve. I don't know how people get up in the morning. I don't know how you do it if you're not an optimist. I don't know how you get out of bed thinking, oh, another bloody day. It must be a brutally, brutally painful thing to live through, I assume.
Absolutely, man. I couldn't agree more.
Hey, let's go to, maybe you talked about some of them, maybe you haven't. What trends are you keeping an eye on? What thing can be about investing, it can be media, it can be podcasting, it can be life in general, finance or not. What's fascinating you at the moment? What are you seeing change that you're keeping a close eye on?
Yeah, sure. I'll give you two really quick ones. What we've realized, we're just capping off our 10th event today, actually, which is wonderful.
Awesome.
The two things that have come out of our national event over the last 2 months is this: AI. I don't want to timestamp this too much, but basically, there's people who just think that it's going to totally revolutionize the world. I think it will, but not in the way a lot of people think. Just like the internet, we didn't know exactly how it would form, and so I think there's people that believe that it's going to completely upend everything we do. I don't think it's that. I just think it's a huge boost to productivity, kind of like the internet. So I think if you're a knowledge worker, if you're something like this, find a way to use it to your advantage and do that soon. Don't necessarily buy into the hype around it's going to end the world, it's going to take over. I just don't think that's going to happen. Second, and that's because of the optimism point that you just mentioned. And the second thing is that more and more we're seeing families and couples talking about money. And I think the democratization through things like the Motley Fool, through online brokering, through apps and through the Royal Commission and these types of things, cleaning out a lot of the stuff, I think what we've seen is the next step in the evolution of people becoming good with money. And the next step is people learning how to learn about all of the soft things. So how do I talk to my partner about money? How do I talk to my kids? I can't just give my kids money because they'll just squander it. And so I think that's the next generation of what we're seeing in financial education and the next generation of Australians, frankly. So I think we'll see that proliferate over the next 10 years.
Very cool, mate. I hope those things are absolutely true. I agree with you on AI, by the way. We won't get into that, but I completely agree. Hey, what advice would you give someone who is interested in taking an entrepreneurial journey?
Yeah, it's the best advice I've heard in the last 2 years, and it came from a guy called Glenn James, who runs the My Millennial Money podcast. I think as young men in particular, we underweight the importance of speaking to someone. So whether that's a psychologist, a mentor, something like that, is if you are going to go on this journey, make sure you're taking care of your mental health, because it's a hard road. And the easiest thing to do is just get a free mental health plan from someone, from your doctor, and they'll be able to sort you out for free. And just take the time to talk about them. You might think you're fine. We all do. And that's the irony. But I wish I'd known that sooner. Not to say that going on the journey is a bad thing, but I just think it's really important, because you've got to know why you're doing it. And if you don't know why, when it gets hard, you won't continue.
Love it, mate. This is really important. I like the focus on mental health too, not mental illness, right? So it's about taking care of your health, and like we do in most things in life, you don't wait till you're sick to deal with stuff. Make a proactive plan to get in front of it. Mate, I'm going to ask you the last question anyway, because it's how I like to finish the podcast. And maybe it's the same answer, maybe it's different. What specifically are you optimistic about, Owen?
I'm optimistic about companies solving more problems. I think companies, businesses, however you want to frame it, are the single best mechanism for solving the world's problems. I'm a very, very hard believer in business being able to do that. Capitalism, asterisks with bumper bars. And so I think that is the reason people go to work, and it's the reason companies exist, is they can solve problems cheaper than someone else. So I would say I'm super optimistic about that. I'm super optimistic about long-term investing. I can't believe I even say those three words together, because it's just investing. But I just think if you've got money, if you've got time, invest it wisely, because the world is becoming a better place.
Beautifully put. Hey, mate, there are so many RASC properties around the place, but I'm going to ask you anyway and see if you can summarize them for us. How can people stay in touch? How can they learn more from you? How can they get more from you? How can they follow you personally and the RASC group in general?
Sure. You can just head to www.rask.com.au. That's the easiest. It's kind of like our gateway. But then we have podcasts. You can just search RASK, RASK. I'm on Twitter. I'm lucky enough to be followed by Scott. So if you just click on Scott's profile, you might see me in there. Owen Rask is me. And that's it. Yeah. Thanks, mate. I really appreciate you taking time to have me on.
Been an absolute joy. I am so excited about the things you're achieving, mate. I'm a massive fan from the sidelines, and I'm glad I got a chance to share your story, both in terms of past, present, and most importantly, future with our listeners. Make sure you do follow Owen on Twitter. Make sure you go to rask.com.au and find out more about what he is doing. He's doing some really important, really fascinating stuff, and the world will be a better place for the work that he's doing. Owen, thank you for joining me on The Good Oil.
Thanks, Scott. Means a lot.
This podcast is hosted by me, Scott Phillips, produced by Ed Gooden, and imaged by Link Kelly.